Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammang sangham namassami. So today for the sutta class, we're reading out number 60, it's called the Apanaka Sutta, the incontrovertible teaching. And the reason I'm reading this one out today, I looked on the list, I haven't done this before, and there's a good reason why I haven't done this before, is that it's quite long. But nevertheless, we'll get into it. And the other reason why I decided to read this when I was in Melbourne, one young man said, where in the sutras does it say absolutely clearly, specifically, without a shadow of doubt, that the Buddha believes in reincarnation? And so I quoted this one. So it's a very clear statement about the law of karma and rebirth, and also it's a very nice teaching here. It also shows that just as though, as in these days, there are many people of skeptics who will not believe unless they have clear evidence. In the time of the Buddha, there were just such people, and this is how the Buddha dealt with the skeptics. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, a Blessed One was wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of monks, and eventually he arrived at a Kosalan Brahmin village named Sala. The Brahmin household of Sasara heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of monks and has come to Sala. Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread thus, and this is where we got Itipiso, that Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable, leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. That's the Itipiso Bhagava Arahant, which shall we chant. And he declares this world with its gods, its maras, its brahmas, its generations, with its recluses and brahmas, its princes and people, which he himself has realized with direct knowledge. And he teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. And he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now it is good to see such arahats. So even though they may not have been Buddhists, they respected him and decided it was worthwhile going to see him. Then the Brahmin household of Sasara went to the Blessed One. Some paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side, which means they were disciples. Some exchanged greetings with him, which means that they respected him. And when his courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side. And some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and sat down at one side. And those was ones who sort of respected him, but not that much. And some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. And some just kept silent and sat down at one side, which means those are the ones who weren't that sort of respectful. And to this day, when you say always at one side, it's usually if you go to Buddhist temples, you never sit directly in front of the teacher. You always sit to one side. And it seems to come from the old Indian tradition. You never sit right in front of the teacher. Because sometimes you see people like that. This is from my perspective. I've been a monk for many years. Some people, they sit right in front of you. And what they're saying is, look at me, I'm your best disciple, your chief disciple. And sometimes, you know, they look at you with a really sickly smile on their face all the time. So it's much better if you know, sit to the side. Actually, that happened to Ajahn Viradharma once when he gave a retreat to England. Sort of, there was a question. He was teaching a meditation retreat in England. This girl sat in front of him for the first few days, right in front of him, smiling at him all the time. And his worst fears were realized when he saw a note on his cushion. And he opened it up. Whoops. He opened up the note and it said, "Will you run away and marry me?" So that's why we don't have what people sitting right in front, because I know what happens next. So he sat down at one side. When they were seated, the Blessed One asked them, "Householder, is there any teacher agreeable to you in you in whom you have acquired faith supported by reason?" In other words, have you found any teacher you can respect? And they replied, "No, venerable sir, There is no teacher agreeable to us in whom we have acquired faith supported by reason. It's the skeptic, the people who haven't found anyone they can really respect and agree with. So the Buddha replied, since, householders, you have not found an agreeable teacher, you may undertake and practice this incontrovertible teaching. For when the incontrovertible teaching is accepted and undertaken, it will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. And what is this incontrovertible teaching? A teaching which you cannot argue with. So here we go. Householders, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad actions, no this world, no other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. Now, unfortunately, the Bhikkhu Bodhi does translate too literally sometimes, and again, real translation should be translating the meaning, not the words. When they say there is nothing given, that literally means there's no dana, there's no karma, there is no fruit or result of good and bad karma. In other words, people don't believe in karma. Do what you like and there will be no effect. Know this world, know the other world, that means no reincarnation. This world and the other world is a place you go, a new life after you die. So really, if I was translating that, I would say, some who have doctrinal view of this, there is no karma, do whatever you like, it doesn't matter, there is no reincarnation. No mother, no father, in other words, you don't need to respect your parents, it doesn't really matter what you do. No beings who are reborn spontaneously, that's ghosts and devas. No good and virtuous recluses of Brahmins in this world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. And all these teachers, they're just charlatans. They haven't realized by themselves the truth of these things. They don't know whether there's karma, whether there's reincarnation, whether there's ghosts and devas. They're just making up as they go along. If I was translating this, this is what I would say. So it's actually translating the meaning rather than the words. Now, is that okay? You understand what they're saying here? This is sometimes the idioms, the way we say things. For example, even these days, you know, you may say, like the spiritualist, he's gone to the other side. The other side of where? The other side of the street? South of the river? Is that what you mean? Because we have idioms, and the idioms have meaning. So if you know, if you got a message from the other side, and that means from the sort of spirit world or the ghost world or something. So these words have meanings, and we need to translate the meaning rather than the words. So that's what this is meaning here. If ever you come across this in these books, nothing given, offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad actions, that means no karma. No this world, other world, that means no reincarnation from this world to the next world. No mother, no father, no respect. No beings who were born spontaneously means no devas and ghosts. And no people who know what they're talking about. Now, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those recluses and Brahmins who say there is no karma, there's no rebirth, there's no people who know what they're talking about. What do you think, householders? Don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other? So some say there is, some say there isn't. Yes, venerable sir. Now, householders, of those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is there is no karma, there is no rebirth, and there is no people who understand anything about this, it is to be expected they will avoid these three wholesome states. Namely, they would avoid good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct. And that will undertake and practice these three unwholesome states, bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. Why is that? Because those good recklessness and Brahmins do not see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation and defilement, nor do they see in wholesome states the blessings of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So in short, if there's no karma, there's no rebirth, and all these monks and nuns and teachers who say there is, they don't know what they're talking about, they won't see any benefit in good actions. Why be good? We all die, we all end up in the same place, which is nowhere. Now, paragraph 8, This is where the Buddha said, since there actually is another world, in other words, there is reincarnation, one who holds that there is no reincarnation has wrong view. Now, I always actually like this one because the Buddha's actually saying this is wrong view here. It's not as if any view is wrong view. There is such a thing as wrong view. And because the Buddha's saying there is reincarnation, anyone who holds a view that is not a reincarnation has wrong view. Since there actually is another world, reincarnation, one who intends there is no other world has wrong intention. Since actually, in other words, may there be not another world, they've got wrong intention. Since there actually is another world, or they have there is reincarnation, one who makes the statement there is no reincarnation has wrong speech. Since there actually is reincarnation, one who says there is no reincarnation is opposed to those arahats who know that other world, know what happens after death. Since there actually is another world, reincarnation, one who convinces another there is no reincarnation convinces him to accept an untrue Dhamma, and because he convinces another to accept an untrue Dhamma, he praises himself and disparages others. I am much better than you guys. Thus any pure virtue that he formerly had is abandoned, and corrupt conduct is substituted. And this wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept an untrue Dhamma, and self-praise and disparagement of others, these several evil unwholesome states thus come into being with wrong view as their condition. Because you think it's Buddhist then, because there is reincarnation, if you say there isn't, you get into a lot of trouble. About this, a wise man considers thus. If there is no reincarnation, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person will have made himself safe enough. If you've been good, it's okay. But if there is another world, then on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. So he's saying that person we're just talking about doesn't believe in rebirth. Okay, if there's no rebirth, he's okay. But if there isn't, he's in trouble. Now, whether or not the word of those good recklessness and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no other world. There is no reincarnation. Still, this person is here. They always call them a good person, even if they're bad people, because they're very polite. Still, this good person. That's when sometimes when I see you, I say, my good man. That doesn't mean you're good. It's just a nice way of speaking. Still, this good person is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one of wrong view, who holds a doctrine of nihilism. This is the doctrine of nihilism in Buddhism. There's no reincarnation, only this one life. But on the other hand, if there is another world, then this good person has made an unlucky throw on both counts. Since he is censured by the wise here and now, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation, in unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. He has wrongly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends only to one side and it excludes the wholesome alternative. Now, householders, of those recklessness and Brahmins whose doctrinal view is this, there is what is given, there is good karma and bad karma, there is reincarnation, and there are good and virtuous recklessness and Brahmins in this world who have themselves realized, not just taken on faith, but realized by direct knowledge, and declare this world and how it works and reincarnation, it is to be expected of those that they will avoid these three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. And they will undertake and practice these three wholesome states, namely good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct. Why is that? Because those good recklessness and Brahmins see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilement, and they see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation and the aspect of cleansing. Again, since there actually is another world, there is reincarnation, one who holds the view there is another world has right view. Since there actually is another world, one who intends there is another world has right intention. In other words, they think in terms of another world as part of the cosmos, then they have right intention. Since there actually is another world, one who makes the statement there is another world has right speech. Since there actually is another world, one who says there is another world is not opposed to those arahats who know the other world. Since there actually is another world, one who convinces another there is another world convinces him to accept a true Dhamma. And because he convinces another to accept true Dhamma, he does not praise himself and disparage others. Thus any corrupt conduct that he formerly had is abandoned, and pure virtue is substituted. And this right view, right intention, right speech, non-opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept true Dhamma and avoiding a self-praise and disparagement of others, these several wholesome states thus come into being with right view as their condition. And about this a wise man considers. If there is another world, then on the dissolution of the body after death, this good person will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Now, whether or not the word of those good directors and Brahmins is true, let me assume there is no other world. This is just the assumption. Still, this person is here and now praised by the wise as a virtuous person, one with right view, who holds to the doctrine that got his affirmation of a rebirth and karma. And on the other hand, if there is another world, then this good person has made a lucky throw on both counts, since he is praised by the wise here and now, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a happy destination even in the heaven world. He has rightly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that extends to both sides and excludes the unwholesome alternative. So what the Buddha is saying over there is whether you believe in karma and rebirth or not, that if you do believe in karma and rebirth and you get it wrong, at least because you believe in karma and rebirth, you'd be a much better person and you do good things in this world. And just that by itself is worthy of praise and worthy of respect by others. You're a good person. So people who do good karma get happiness here and now, even if there is not another world. I think many people, they understand that enough, that whether they believe in good karma or not, as far as good karma, which is going to produce good effects in a future life, you know it produces good effects in this life. And for many people that's good enough. However, there are some people who don't believe in karma at all, don't believe in rebirth. And for many people like that, there is opening the opportunity for them to really do a lot of misconduct because they think they're going to get away with it. They don't believe in karma, that if they can manage to escape the consequences of the police, the consequences of the law, the worldly consequences, they'll just do it and think that when they die, who cares, we're all the same anyway. So the Buddha was saying that it's probably better because even if there is no rebirth, at least you get praise and happiness in this life. And you get respect from other people. Therefore it's worth doing. Is that point well made, or have I rushed it too fast? Any pause for comment? Yeah. Oh yeah. He's talking about enlightened beings. And all those beings who are enlightened and are accepted as enlightened by most other such beings, they always say that there is such a thing as rebirth, that there is such a thing as karma. I don't know if you've ever read this mystic Edgar Cayce, who was alive between the First and Second World Wars. And of all these people who were supposed to channel others, he was one who was tested and tried. And he seemed to be the real deal. It's interesting to read some of his stories. But once when they put this fellow in trance, remember he was like from the Bible Belt, you know, before the Second World War, a very, very devout Christian, I think a Baptist. And they put him in trance and somebody asked him the question, what's the most important law of the universe? And he replied, karma. And that was really weird, because I don't think hardly anyone knew what the word meant. And when he came out afterwards, and looked in the dictionary what it meant, and found it was a Buddhist Hindu thing, he was really upset. he was a Christian. And he just said this amazing stuff. So it's an interesting person to read, Edgar Cayce. So an arahat is like an enlightened being. Is that what you were asking? What is? Okay. That's right. The ones who are really wise and enlightened, who do have deep meditation, who do actually speak you from knowledge, speak that yes, there is such a thing as reincarnation. And this is why you don't have to be an enlightened person. That's why here in retreats I've asked people to go to such deep meditation, which some of you have done, and ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And see if you can recollect your past lives. So you can prove it for yourself. Okay, it does make a difference in the way you live. Because if you realize that, you know, you're not going to just disappear in a few more years, you're going to come back again, then you always think, what am I going to come back as? So it means you're not so heedless in your last years. You don't think, oh, I can do whatever I want because I'm out of here soon. It means that you have to be very careful by body, speech, and mind. But people who don't believe in an afterlife, they're the ones who are more likely to actually act bad and selfishly and greedily because they think their actions have no consequences. Make sense? But then, even if it doesn't, your actions of body, speech and mind have consequences in this life. So that really should be enough for you to do good karma. It should be, if you really think about it. Here we go. And it just carries on this way. Householder, there are some requisites and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. When one acts or makes others act, when one mutilates or makes others mutilate, when one tortures or makes others inflict torture, when one inflicts sorrow or makes others inflict sorrow, when one oppresses or makes others inflict oppression, when one intimidates or makes others inflict intimidation, when one kills living beings, takes what's not given, breaks into houses, plunders wealth, commits burglary, ambushes highways, seduces another's wife, utters falsehood, no evil is done by the doer. And this is, first of all, to point out, it's not just what you do yourself, it's what you instigate other people to do as well. This law of karma is, it's not just what you do, it's what you make other people do as well. So even though sort of Mr. Bush didn't pull any guns, if he's the commander-in-chief of an army, he has to take on some of the karma of what his army does. And they go in with this simile, if with a razor-rimmed wheel, one were to make the living beings on this earth, all the beings on this earth, into one mass of flesh, into one heap of flesh. Because of this, there would be no evil and no outcome of evil. If one were to go along the south bank of the Ganges, killing and slaughtering, mutilating and making others mutilate, torturing and making others inflict torture, because of this, there would be no evil and no outcome of evil. If one were to go along the north bank of the Ganges, the other one, giving gifts and encouraging others to make gifts, making offerings and encouraging others to make offerings, because of this there will be no merit and no outcome of merit. By giving, by taming oneself, by restraint, by speaking truth, there is no merit and no outcome of merit. This is going even more into the fact of doing good or doing bad. This says some people say it doesn't really matter. Whatever you do. Now, there are some requisites and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those requisites and Brahmins, and they say thus. They say, when one acts or makes others act, when one mutilates or makes others mutilate, evil is done by the doer. And if with a razor-rimmed wheel one were to make living beings on this earth into one mass of flesh, a heap of flesh, because of this there would be evil, an outcome of evil. If one were to go along the south bank of the Ganges, killing, slaughtering, mutilating, etc., because of this there would be evil and the outcome of evil. If one were to go along the north bank of the Ganges, giving gifts and making others give gifts, making offerings and making others make offerings, because of this there would be merit and the outcome of merit. By giving, by taming oneself, by restraint, by speaking truth, there is merit and the outcome of merit. What do you think, householders? Don't these rectuses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other? Yes, venerable sir. That's why some people who come saying, take food to the nuns or to the monks, say, what are you doing that for? Say, making merit. There's no such thing as merit. Those monks are fat enough, they can feed themselves. Those nuns, they know how to cook. Why do you need to sort of go and take things for them? And they say, oh, and there's no such wrong in sort of, sometimes you just, you know, some people are in the way. Sometimes you've got to sort of torture in order to get the information to save your country. That's the Dick Cheney doctrine. So there's nothing wrong in that. So there are people who actually say this. Now the Buddha is saying, now householder, of those recklesses and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this, when one acts or makes others act, there is no merit or no outcome of merit. It is to be expected that they will avoid the three wholesome states of good bodily conduct, verbal conduct and mental conduct, and they will undertake and practice the three wholesome conducts of bodily, verbal and mental. Why is that? Because those recklesses and Brahmins do not see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation and defilement, nor do they see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation and the aspect of cleansing. Since there actually is action, one who holds the view there is no action, this is doing here, but it's really action, has wrong view. Since there actually is action, one who intends there is no action has just wrong intention. Since there actually is action, one who makes a statement there is no action has wrong speech. Since there actually is action, one who says there is no action, suppose there are arahats who hold the doctrine that there is action, that there is karma. Since actually is action, one who convinces another there is no action convinces him to accept an untrue Dhamma. And because he convinces another to accept an untrue Dhamma, he praises himself and disparages others. There's an interesting point here that every time it says when you commit someone to accept an untrue Dhamma, your ego increases. So in other words, you praise others and put down others who disbelieve in you or who disagree with you. Whenever you accept a good Dhamma, such as a Dhamma of good bodily speech, for instance, then good bodily speech is not praising sort of yourself and disparaging others. It's teaching everybody equally. Thus, any pure virtue that he formerly had is abandoned and corrupt conduct is substituted. And this wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept an untrue Dhamma, and self-praise and disparagement of others, these several evil unwholesome states thus come into being with wrong view as their condition. But about this a wise man considers thus. If there is no action, no doing and the consequences of doing, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person who is behaving badly will have made himself safe enough. But there is the consequence of action. Then on dissolution of the body after death, that guy will reappear in a state of deprivation, in unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now whether or not the word of those good recklesses and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no action. Now whatever you do doesn't have any effect. Still this good person is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one of wrong view, who holds a doctrine of non-doing. But on the other hand, if there is action, then this good person has made an unlucky throw on both counts. Since he is censured by the wise here and now, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. He has wrongly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends to only one side and excludes that wholesome alternative. Now, householders, of those recklesses and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this, when one acts or makes others act, there is merit and outcome of merit. It is to be expected they will avoid these three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal and mental misconduct, and that they will undertake and practice the three wholesome states, namely good bodily conduct, verbal conduct and mental conduct. Why is that? because those good Rakshasas and Brahmins see in unwholesome states the danger of degradation and defilement, and they see in wholesome states the blessings of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. Since there actually is action and consequences, one who holds the view there is no action has right view. Since there actually is action, one who intends there is action has right intention. Since there actually is action, one who makes a statement there is action has right speech. Since there actually is action, one who says there is action is not opposed to those arahats who hold the doctrine that there is action. And since there actually is action, one who convinces another is action convinces him to accept a true Dhamma. And because he convinces another to accept a true Dhamma, and with it comes the right conduct, you don't praise himself, disparage others. Thus, any corrupt conduct that he formerly had is abandoned, and pure virtue is substituted. And this right view, right intention, right speech, non-opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept a true Dhamma, and avoidance of self-praise and disparagement of others, these several wholesome states has come into being with right view as their condition. And about this, the wise man considers thus: if there is action and its consequences, then on the dissolution of the body after death, this good person will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Now, whether or not the word of those good recklessness and balance is true, let me assume that there is no doing. Still, this good person is here and now praised by the wise as a virtuous person, one with right view who holds the doctrine of doing. And on the other hand, if there is action, then this good person has made a lucky throw on both counts, since he is praised by the wise here and now, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. He has rightly accepted and undertaken his incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends to both sides and excludes the unwholesome alternative. So you see, it's the same argument here, just applied more focused on the law of karma, on doing. The first one was more like focused on rebirth, basically saying, well, whatever you believe, if you believe it or you don't believe it, still that if you do believe in the outcome of good karma, it's likely that there's more incentive for you to do good bodily, mental and speech actions. Therefore, you'll be praised here and now. You'll be respected by other people. And if there is life after death, then you will go to a heaven realm. So whichever way is worthwhile, doing good acts of body, speech and mind. Is that getting okay? I know that second one, I don't know if any of you ever read the Bhagavad Gita, but one of the reasons why I rejected Hinduism when I first had a look at it, or that particular doctrine, was when Arjuna was going to go into battle, in this great battle which was part of the Mahabharata, the great Indian epic. He's about to go into battle against his brothers, because whenever people go into war, it's never so clear-cut which nation against which nation. It's always your friends and brothers and maybe your in-laws. And there you are facing one another, about to slaughter each other. And this warrior, Arjuna, had a lot of doubts. He said, I can't do this. I can't go and kill my brothers and friends. And then there was, if I remember correctly, there was the god Krishna was standing next to him and said, what do you mean? You're not killing them. You're just killing their bodies. Their souls are indestructible. So, you know, you can't do anything wrong. You're not killing anybody. And when I heard that, I thought, no, that doesn't make sense at all to me. That's a sort of cop-out. So that's one of the reasons that particular philosophy I didn't agree with at all. But you can see this is one of the philosophies here. How can you kill anybody when you believe in an immortal soul? Or even that, if it's all meant to be, it's God's will. You're not really killing anybody, you're just carrying out the will of some other being, a god or an Allah. So you can see just how people can justify, there is no action, there's no responsibility of what I do. It's God's will. Or I can't really kill anybody anyway, because, as I said the other night, when I first went to Thailand, I was very surprised that these Buddhist villagers would be fishing from the paddy fields in the monsoon period. I say, you're breaking your precepts. You're supposed to be good Buddhists, you're killing those fish. And they say, we don't kill any fish. We just take them out of the water and they die by themselves. And you can see where this sort of idea comes from. There is no killing. You know, we don't torture people, just cut their bodies in half and they die by themselves. We didn't kill them. So sometimes people can justify things and say there's no bad karma involved in all of this. And because of that, you know, whether there is or there isn't, people, you know, like Dick Cheney, you know, do get blamed for, they do lose respect, you know, from what they did in Guantanamo Bay and how they tortured people in Abu Ghraib prison. So either way, it's not really worth it. But a person who does believe in karma and rebirth, what the Buddha is saying here, they got more incentive to be a better person. Yeah.
I was just thinking that it perhaps blurs this idea of good and evil. So if killing is good, then is that good?
Blurs. Yeah. That's correct. So they don't know. But at least they know that right here, right now, if you refuse to kill, you get praise. I remember telling this in one of the talks. Because I was a monk during the Vietnam War, and some of the monks I knew were soldiers in that war, so it was very close to me when they told me many of their stories. But there was a very famous event in that war called the My Lai Massacre, when the US soldiers went into a village and they were told to kill every man, woman and child in that village. It was a war crime, the My Lai Massacre. And a reporter managed to find that out, and was headline news. That was obviously going too far. And to this day, I remember the lieutenant in charge, Lieutenant Kelly, was court-martialed, put in jail for about a few months, and then was given a pardon by the President of the United States. You know, because most of the United States citizens thought that, no, it didn't really matter, he was just doing his job as a soldier. But it was 25 years after that terrible event that some enterprising TV crew did a documentary on as many people they could track from that company of soldiers who had actually done that massacre. And whether they were punished or not, or forgiven or not, all of them had these terrible psychological problems. Could not hold down the relationship with their partner, were drunk, were on drugs, were in prison. The karmic consequences of doing something like that were immense. There's always one person or two people who stand out, almost like the control, to see what happened when a person didn't follow those orders. And they said there was this one black African soldier who refused the order to go in. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. So he was court-martialed, and he was put in jail for much longer time than the commanding officer. He was not pardoned. He did much time in that jail. But he was eventually released. And of all those soldiers, he is now the happy one, the one who feels good about himself, who has a good relationship and doing well in life. He took a good moral stand, even though he knew that refusing an order in a war would mean he would have to go to jail. And they asked him, why did you do that? Were you a religious person? He said, no, I didn't really believe in religion. And he said, do you know the consequences of what you're doing? Were you stupid? Did you realize you would have to go to a military jail, which is far tougher than a civil jail? He said, I knew what was going to happen. Why did you do that? How could you refuse an order when all the other people accepted that order and went to kill? He said, because it was wrong. I just knew it was wrong. I just couldn't do it. That's why I said no. And you can see her as an amazing being who, faced with a moral choice and knowing the consequences mean you go to jail, he just could not follow that order. And the long-term consequences of that, yeah, he spent 2 or 3 years in suffering, for the rest of his life, he's a happy person. As all those people who took the easy course and went in, suffering and suffering in the prison of their conscience. Interesting, just there is consequences to one's actions. And you can't just say, oh, just somebody ordered me to do that. There's huge consequences. So people who say there isn't, oh, just someone else give you order, just let it go. It's too tough to do. So that's why the Buddha is saying that even if, you know, you don't believe in the consequences of actions, you know, just being a good person, not killing, not torturing, and not lying, not cheating others, it has consequences right here which you can know, let alone consequences in the future. So either way, just knowing the consequences here and now, in this life, means you have a lucky throw. And if there is rebirth, you win twice. By not believing in these things, by not acting with good speech, action and mind, you lose both ways. In this life, you have a very lot of pain, psychological trauma, and if there is another life, you're going to lose again. That's why it says it's uncontrovertible. Does that make the point? Now he goes again with the doctrine of non-causality. There is some requisites and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. There is no cause and condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause and condition. In other words, it's just if you're a good person, you're very lucky. If you ain't, well, it's just God's will. Can't do anything about it. Or it's just the way you were born. You're just an evil being. There's no cause. Also, there's no cause and condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified without cause and condition. In other words, just some people are just born enlightened beings. You know, they just don't have to work hard. They don't have to do anything. They're just enlightened. There is no power, no energy, no manly strength, no manly endurance, or womanly endurance and strength. All beings, all living things, all creatures, all souls are without mastery, power and energy, moulded by destiny, circumstance and nature. They experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. Now there are some requisites and Brahmins. One of the six classes, I'll look at the end. I think it's the six senses, I'd imagine. Oh no, I think it could be six classes. Pleasure, pain, in between, and the same with mental. Now there are some requisites and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those requisites and Brahmins and say thus. They say there is a cause and condition for the defilement of beings. In other words, there's a cause if you can actually stop that cause. Beings are defiled owing to a cause and condition. There is a cause and condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified owing to a cause and condition. There is power, energy, manly strength, manly endurance. It is not the case that all beings, all living beings, all creatures, all souls are without mastery, power and energy, or that moulded by destiny, circumstances and nature, they experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. In other words, somebody say nothing you can do about it. So I'm just meant to be poor. I'm meant to be stupid. I'm just meant to be like this. So what's the point of trying? And anyway, 23a1. Now, householders, of those requisites and Brahmins, whose doctrine review is this. There is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. They just experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. It is to be expected they will avoid those three wholesome states, namely good bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct. What's the point? And they will undertake and practice the three unwholesome states, bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. Why is that? Because those good requisites and Brahmins do not see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilement, nor do they see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. If you think you can't do anything about it, then you won't even try to be good. Since there actually is causality, it's not just determined, it's not fated. One who holds a view that is no causality has wrong view. Since there actually is causality, instead of destiny, one who intends there is no causality has wrong intention. Since there actually is causality, one who makes the statement there is no causality has wrong speech. since there actually is causality. One who says there is no causality is opposed to those arahats who hold the doctrine of causality. Since there actually is causality, one who convinces another there is no causality convinces him to accept an untrue Dhamma. And because he convinces another to accept an untrue Dhamma, he praises himself and disparages others. Thus any pure virtue that he formerly had is abandoned, and corrupt conduct is substituted. And this wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept an untrue Dhamma, and self-praise and disparagement of others, these several even unwholesome states thus come into being with wrong view as their condition. About this, a wise man considers us. If there is no causality, in other words, it's all destined, it's all meant to be, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person will have made himself safe enough. It's not his fault. So if you do bad things and you go up to heaven, or you go up to hell, say, why are you sending me to hell, God? You made me do these things. Not my fault. He made himself safe enough. But if there is causality, then the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation and unhappy destination in perdition, even in hell. Now, whether or not the word of these good recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no causality. In other words, if you do something wrong, the devil made me do it. Not my fault. Actually, I remember just a long time ago when I was a student, there's this comedian, who was it? He did this wonderful skit about the... Sorry? Flip Wilson, the devil made me do it. It's very, very funny. I remember, I think he was playing a girl who came home and she bought this expensive dress from the shop. And she said, I didn't do it, the devil made me do it. And it was very, very funny just how he was outside the shop. He said, no, I don't need a dress. But the devil said, you need a dress, you need a dress. So I had to go in, the devil made me do it. So of course the devil doesn't make you do it, you do it yourself. The devil hasn't got a credit card. And where was I? Where did I get to? 25, wasn't it, somewhere? About this a wise man considers. If there is no causality, it's all fated, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person would have made himself safe enough. But if there is causality, on the dissolution of the body after death, he will appear in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination in perdition, even in hell. Now, whether or not the word of those good recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume there is no causality. Still, this good person is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one who takes no responsibility. One of wrong view, one who holds a doctrine of non-causality. But on the other hand, if there is causality, then this good person who has made an unlucky throw on both counts, in this world and the next. Since he is censured by the wise here and now, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. He has wrongly accepted and undertaken his incontrovertible teaching in such a way that extends only to one side and excludes the wholesome alternative. Now, householders of those requisites and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this, there is cause and condition for the defilement of beings, and they experience pleasure and pain in the six classes, it is to be expected they will avoid these three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct, because these are the causes for the unwholesome consequences. And they will undertake and practice these three wholesome states, namely good bodily contact, verbal contact, and mental conduct, because they know these are the causes for happiness. Why is that? Because those good recluses and Brahmins see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilement, and they see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. And it's such as Paul said that in the wholesome states it takes renunciation, it takes a sense of saying no to one's baser defilements and for the cravings and the sense of I want. So to do good takes a sense of renouncing, giving up something, and a sense of cleansing afterwards when one feels more free. Since there actually is causality, there is, in other words, you're not meant to be, you can cause things to change. That's why when people say, even recently, someone came up to me yesterday and they're having a bit of bad luck in their family and their life, and they say, is it because of the karma we did? Because when they were young, they had an abortion. Am I fated to have to suffer for this? No, it's causality. Yeah, there is a result of that, but you're keeping on making causality. You can change things around. Causality means it's not fated. You can mend things, change things. That's what the law of causality is. In other words, it encourages you to do some good things because you can alter things. You're not fated to suffer. So, since there actually is causality, they have right view. This is 27b2. That's where I got to, wasn't it? Okay. Since there actually is causality, one who intends his causality has right intention. Since there actually is causality, one who makes a statement that is causality has right speech. Since there actually is causality, one who says there is causality is not opposed to those arahats who hold the doctrine of causality. Since there actually is causality, one who convinces another there is causality convinces him to accept a true Dharma. And because he convinces another to accept a true Dharma, he doesn't praise himself and disparage others. Thus, any corrupt conduct that he formerly had is abandoned, and pure virtue is substituted, and this right view, right intention, right speech, non-opposition to the noble ones, the arahats, convincing another to accept true Dharma, and avoidance of self-praise and disparagement of others, these several wholesome states thus come into being with the right view as their condition. And about this, a wise man considers thus, or woman, if there is causality then on the dissolution of the body after death, this good person will reappear in a happy destination, even the heavenly world. Now, whether or not the word of those good requisites and bombs is true, let me assume that there is no causality. But still this good person who believes in causality is here and now praised by the wise as a virtuous person, one with right view, who holds the doctrine of causality. And on the other hand, if there is causality, then this good person has made a lucky throw on both counts, since he is praised by the wise here and now, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a happy destination even in the heavenly world. He has rightly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends to both sides and excludes the unwholesome alternative. So there we are. We've got the first three of the incontrovertible teachings, rebirth, karma, and just a more deeper understanding of karma, the causality. So whether you believe it or not, it's worth taking it on board, because then you'll win on both counts. You'll have the lucky throw. And the reason they say lucky throw, because people would play dice. That was a common form of gambling in the time of the Buddha. And there are many stories about people playing dice. And even when I went to the museum in New Delhi some years ago, there was one of the artifacts which was excavated from Mohenjo-daro, which was pre-Buddhist, this great civilization before the Aryan invasion of India. There was a dice there. But interestingly enough, on our dice, still got the six sides, 1 to 6. But on our dice, the opposite sides always add up to 7. The 1 is opposite the 6. The 5 is opposite the 2. And the 3 is opposite to the 4. In this one, they weren't sort of balanced in that way. They were all over the place. So there were dice about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. Very old form of gambling. So that's why they say a lucky throw. In other words, you gamble and you back the right horse. Any comments? Yeah. How's that? Because sometimes you believe in God, you get censured by the wise in this life, not praised by the wise. But it's sometimes if one believes in a God, it really depends upon how that belief is actually explained to you. If it's believed in like a power which actually goes against causality. In other words, like God will look after you no matter what you do. All you need to do is to believe in God. Then you can see that doesn't encourage good actions of body or speech or mind. It basically, you abandon your responsibility for good conduct. So therefore you don't get praised by the wise. You do get censured because you have bad conduct. That's right, yeah. So is it a sort of belief which, whether it's true or not, encourages good conduct in this life? And And interestingly, this article was pointed out to me by Ajahn Sujata, that there was a sociologist over in the United States, I think, what is the name, something Paul. I have his article back in my monastery. If I can remember his first name, so you can actually look it up on the internet. But he was investigating the claim by Christian groups in the United States that those people who believe in Jesus Christ are more moral people, more ethical. So he managed to use freely available statistics, both in the United States and overseas, where he compared the number of people who went to church in a community with the number of homicides, divorces, abortions, incarcerations, you know, through crimes, indicators of low ethics. And actually, he made a wonderful sort of conclusion. He said it was very clear that there was a positive correspondence between church going and increases in homicides, abortions, thefts, and incarcerations. It's completely opposite. But what was really interesting when I saw that, I think I gave a talk about it here. Why would that be the case? And one of the reasons is because if you put your faith and responsibility in some God or Jesus, just believe in Jesus and then you'll be all right after you die, it means you don't take responsibility for your actions in this life. And it's that lack of personal responsibility, that lack of taking control and responsibility for your actions, which will be the cause for the increase in unethical behavior. Do you get that? I think who was it? Paul. I know it's Paul was his surname. Do you make that? Do you get that point? Okay. Any other questions or comments on this? Yes. I think that the Buddha is more pointing towards those people who think of destiny and fate. In other words, your future is completely out of your hands. But I think that's made clear earlier, where it says that, where is it? On the very first, on non-causality. There is no cause and condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause and condition. There's no cause and condition for the purification. There's no power, no energy, no manly strength, no manly endurance. All beings, living beings, all creatures, souls are without mastery. That's usually meant in this text like fated and destiny. So in other words, whatever you do, you're destined to be like that, and so just trying to be different or putting forth some wise wisdom power, it's not going to make a difference anyway, so you might as well cop it. And that sort of means that you don't sort of put forth any sort of effort or responsibility at all. That's right. What's the point? Do what you like, because it's not your fault. It's meant to be. So I'm meant to be a thief. I'm meant to be sort of sleeping around with any girl I like. I'm meant to be a rapist and a paedophile. So that's just how I was made. I can't do anything about it. Now you can see, sometimes if you think like that, then there's no effort, no restraint, no way of actually changing things. So any unwholesome states, unskillful states will persist. But if you think that it's not fate, but the you can always interfere and you can always do something, change the situation you're in. It's not fated, but actually in the sense that you're creating your fate and destiny every moment. That's the causality. What you're doing right now, how you choose to respond, is creating your karma in the future. Sankhara is always being created. It's not something which is set in concrete from the time of your birth, but it's like work in progress. Then it means that there's a point to trying to be a better person. Does that make sense? There's a difference between karma as fate and karma as what you can do to change things as you go along. Oh, yeah. That's right. That's one of the points you're making. That story is, it's one of the chants which, because our monastery is subject to bushfires, that we do that chant every bushfire season, and it's a chant which was come from the story of a little bird, a tiny quail. His forest was alight, and so he realized there were beings that he could fly away, but there other beings who couldn't fly, were either just too immature to fly, or the beings on the ground who couldn't sort of crawl fast, they couldn't run away. So he decided to try and save them. How could a little bird stop a forest fire? So he flew to the nearest lake, and he put as much water on his wings as possible, and he was the first water bomber. He'd go over the fire, just shake his wings, and a couple of drops would fall on the fire. And he kept on doing that again and again and again, trying to put the fire out. Impossible, but at least he was trying something. And apparently, according to the story, one of the devas, Saka, saw him and say, "Gee, this bird is something special." He said, "I'll go and give him a hand." And so the deva just snapped his finger and a big fire just stopped. So the quail had stopped the fire. Because it inspired other beings also to come to his assistance by his heroic effort. And there are beings like that. People who sort of face impossible odds, and they know they can't beat the odds, but they can inspire other people to come and help them. Yeah, if you can. Yeah, because sometimes people get inspired by your stance, and other people come to your aid. That's what happened there. But isn't the idea, that's not really what they're saying here, it's just, you don't give up and say it's fated to be. Climate change, we can't do anything about it. Maybe just build a boat. So when the sea water rises, we could actually live in boats. Or whatever else other people think. There's always things you can do about it. So it gives us a sense of responsibility. It's not just all meant to be. That's why I really get upset when people just say, "Oh, it's just meant to be. You know, I'm not going to get enlightened, it's just meant to be. I'm not meant to get into jhanas." Or they come up and say, "Well, I visited a monastery, but I'm not meant to be a monk." What do you mean you're not meant to be a monk? You make yourself into a monk. It's not you're meant to be or not meant to be. That's just an excuse, it's a cop-out. So this is a causality. You create the causes. You make your destiny. Destiny is not pre-written. There is no plan. So don't think it's all written in the stars. You've got the new... It's not the Hubble, it's the Herschel telescope. No one has ever seen any writing in the stars yet. Just blobs of light, that's all. Anyway, there are no immaterial realms. Householder, there are some recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine of view of this. Their doctrine is this. There is no immaterial realms. Now these are even beyond the Deva realms. Just the realms you get into with jhanas. Now, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those recluses and Brahmins, and they say thus there definitely are immaterial realms. What do you think? What do you think, householders? Don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other? Now, I'm not sure what it says in the commentary here, but when the Buddha goes on to something which is a little bit strange here, it must be that they've been discussing this before. So he's picked up on one of their debates, which has recently been happening. So the Buddha continues, "About this, a wise man considers us. These good recluses and Brahmins hold the doctrine in view there are definitely no immaterial realms. But that has not been seen by me. And those other good recluses and Brahmins hold the doctrine in view there definitely are immaterial realms, but that has not been known by me. If without knowing and seeing, I were to take one side and declare, only this is true, anything else is wrong, that would not be fitting for me. Now, as to those recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine in view, there definitely are no material realms. If their word is true, then it is certainly still possible that I might reappear after death among the gods of the fine material realms who consist of mind. That's the jhana realms. But as to the recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine in view, there definitely are immaterial realms. If their word is true, then it is certainly possible that I might reappear after death among the gods of the immaterial realms who consist of perception." Now, this is a very fine point of Buddhism, but it's still a very good part of Buddhism, that we have what sometimes they call in Buddhism the three worlds, the Triloka. And those three worlds are this world of material form, which includes the ghosts, the animals, the hell realms, and the deva realms, the human realms, but even beyond those, the realms of the fine material realms. And this is where there's mind-made bodies. It's still possible I might reappear after death among the gods of the fine material realms, who consist of mind. So this is actually the same realms as you might touch as a temporary experience when you experience a jhana. Pure mind, no physical body, no five senses, just mind. But beyond that are the immaterial realms, that's the third loka, which is just made of perception. These are perceptions. This really starts getting you involved in the fact that the mind is such a strong thing, that the mind creates these worlds. And you can have like a whole world just made of mind, no physical stuff. And even more refined than that, a whole existence which is just made of perception. That's how powerful perception is. Even more powerful, more central than what mind is. A world made totally of perception. How you are creating those realms. Totally. So he said, "But as to those recluses," and after the note 633, "as to those recluses and Brahmins who hold doctrine in view, they are definitely are immaterial realms. So I say, if their word is true, then it is certainly possible I might reappear among the gods of the immaterial realms who consist of perception. So the taking up of rods, weapons, quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice and false speech are seen to occur on material form, but this does not exist at all in the immaterial realms. After reflecting thus, he practices a way of dispassion towards the material form, to the fading away and cessation of material forms." So when he's saying in material realms, he says, well, there are immaterial realms or not, but still you can actually get into these beautiful states of jhanas, and at least you can know that, and that practices the way of dispassion towards the material stuff. Now he goes on to some even deeper stuff. I'm rushing ahead here just so we finish in time, but is that reasonably clear, or is that a bit sort of... Okay. "Householder, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine view is this. There definitely is no cessation of being, no cessation of existence." Now here we go into some of the deepest understandings of what Nirvana is. Is Nirvana just a place where you go when you die, living happily ever after if you're enlightened, enjoying bliss forevermore? Or is Nirvana the cessation of all existence? And you know, if you know me, heard me many times, you know what I keep on saying. This is quite clear from here. "Householder, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, that definitely there is definitely no cessation of existence or of being. Now there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those recluses and Brahmins, and they say there definitely is a cessation of being. What do you think, householders? Don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other? Yes, venerable sir. About this a wise man considers us. These good recluses and Brahmins hold the doctrine and view that definitely is no cessation of beings, but that has not been seen by me. And these other good recluses and Brahmins hold the doctrine and view that it definitely is a cessation of being, but that has not been known by me. If without knowing and seeing I were to take one side and declare, only this is true, anything else is wrong, that would be not fitting for me. Now, as those recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine and view that definitely is no cessation of being, if their word is true, then it certainly is still possible that I might reappear after death among the gods of the immaterial realms who consist of perception. So this is actually beyond the immaterial realms. But as the recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine and view that definitely is a cessation of beings, if their word is true, then it is possible that I might in this very life attain final nibbana. So the Buddha is actually equating here nibbana with a cessation of being or existence. The view of those good recluses and Brahmins who hold a doctrine of view that definitely is no cessation of being is close to lust, close to bondage, close to delighting, close to holding, close to clinging. But the view of those good recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine of view that definitely is cessation of being is close to non-lust, to non-bondage, close to non-delighting, close to non-holding, close to non-clinging. After reflecting that, he practices the way to dispassion towards being, to the fading away and cessation of being. So before you actually know and see it, you can't really say. But at least you know that one is closer to letting go, to cessation, the other one is closer to holding on. So what do? You go to the one which is non-holding, so that you do attain to the cessation of existence, to nibbana. So this whole paragraph here is saying, if you haven't experienced it yet, you don't know what you're saying, but it's still worthwhile going for. Because one is closer to letting go than the other. And you always know that letting go has to be the way to nibbana. If you practice that, then you do lead to letting go, to nibbana. That actually is a very powerful little paragraph there. Does anyone want to comment on that? Is there anyone who says there is an original mind? An original mind where you will, says, which is what happens when you get in line, you'll always be there evermore. People who don't know, have an experience, they don't know. They can't say one or the other. They can't say, yes, there is an original mind. No, there is an original mind. You're just following the beliefs of others. But at least you can know from what it said over here, belief in an original mind is closer to clinging, closer to lust, closer to holding. Belief in nothing at all, no original mind, is closer to non-lust, non-bondage, non-clinging. And after reflecting that, the way you practice the way to dispassion towards all being, the fading away and cessation of existence. So you don't know yet, but you know one looks a much better path. Any comment? Okay, because they don't know that, that is on belief, and other people who know better know that that will not happen. So they're going on a path which is just from belief, whereas Buddhists are going on a path from experience. And the experiences of letting go, of especially creating wholesome states of speech, action and mind, gives you happiness here and now. And you know that, and if it's going to lead to happiness in a future life, you know also that good people must go to good places when they die. Whether they're a Christian or not does not matter. It's whether you're a good person or not matters. So a bad Christian would go to hell, whether they believe in Jesus or not. That's the law of things. So just the belief in a person is not good enough. It's what you do. Maybe in this world, who you know, rather than what you do, can get you advancements in life.
but not in the next world. It's not who you know, but what you do.
So some of those Christian friends, oh, they need to sort of go and hear other teachings, widen their mind, especially develop deep meditation so they can find out for themselves. Not to believe what others say, but to discuss, investigate, find out. Any other questions about that? That was not really what that paragraph was about. This is letting go to attain the full enlightenment. Okay, four kinds of person. And this is almost like tacked on to this. Just having mentioned beliefs, so the different beliefs which people argue about, karma, rebirth, causality or fate, so these, where there are other realms other than the one you know, and now enlightenment. Now getting to some of the sort of nitty-gritty about, do you believe enlightenment, what actually is enlightenment, whichever belief you go for, one seems to be more conducive than the other. Now the Buddha is going to more the practical method of how you become enlightened. He's repeating here something which comes from the other suttas, and this is almost like added on at the end, but this is done in brief in this sutta, has to be done in brief here because this whole passage, the four kind of persons, is very, very long indeed. If you want to read a whole of it, it's first in sutta number 51. But in brief, householder, there are four kinds of person to be found existing in the world. What for? Here a certain kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself. Here a certain kind of person torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. Here a certain kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing others, and he also torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. In other words, you hurt yourself, number one, you hurt others, number two, number three, you hurt both, and number four. And here a certain kind of person does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself, and he does not torment others or pursue the practice of torturing others. Since he torments neither himself nor others, he is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled in the abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy. So these are the four types of persons in the world. And what kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing others? And here he's saying a person who does a religious practice such as standing on one leg, facing the sun. These are all those religious practices where we think that if you torture yourself and experience a lot of pain, then somehow you can get some spiritual awakening. There used to be in Middle Age Europe these people who would, the stylites, started with Simon the stylite, who would actually climb on top of one of these columns. You know, you see these columns in Europe from buildings which had fallen down, the roof had fallen down, but they still had these columns. Now really high, he'd climb up there and just live up there. And in the sun, in the rain, in the snow, he'd just live up there for years. And have a little basket, and he would actually have his food delivered, and he'd bring it up the basket, but he was so ascetic. And literally, that people would think that he was, because he was living such an ascetic life, on the top of one of these columns, that he must be wise. And so people would actually come to him, and actually ask him all these questions about their marriage, about their health, and about all the other problems in life. And that was, he was followed by other people, and they become like the tradition of stylites, S-T-Y-L-I-T-E-S. And it was a very, very common in a certain period of history. People had just really got sucked in. If they were living it so hard, doing such an ascetic practice, they must be wise. And as the person who wrote this book, which I read, said, because they were living in such agony, that was the first agony column where people could ask their questions about their personal situations in life. But that was actually true. Just even today, people still think the more ascetic you are, the wiser you are. And so if you go to India, even today, you get people who live out on the streets who say they sort of eat, sort of, they don't eat at all, or they eat excrement. I remember this other book which somebody wrote, and it's only about 10 or 20 years ago. There's one, this holy man in Benares who would only eat excrement, would never eat anything else. And he was actually waiting to see him actually eat something. And of course he waited until it got dark, until no one was around, and then sort of the guy sort of got up and went home and had curry and rice like everybody else. It was just his way of making a living. It was a bit of a fraud. But nevertheless, people really like asceticism and think asceticism makes you wise. He said, that's the first type of person who tortures yourself. What kind of person torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others? And here a person has like these bad occupations, like as a butcher or as like a soldier. Or anyone who follows another such bloody occupation, a kind of person who torments and perhaps himself, others, and pursues the practice of torturing others. And what kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself and also torments and tortures others? Here some person is like a king or a well-to-do Brahmin, and he has slaves, messengers and servants who make preparations for a big sacrifice. Because remember, people in those days were into sacrifices, thinking if you want to have good luck, then you have to make sacrifices to the gods. So you kill a lot of sheep, you kill a lot of cattle, and you have these big feasts and think that thereby you're going to be helping other people, but thereby you torture yourself, you torture others. And what kind of person, householder, does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself, and does not torment others or pursue the practices of torturing others? And the one who, since he torments neither himself nor others, is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cold, and abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy. And here we go to the gradual training where a person gets faith in the Buddha, they listen to his teaching, and because of that they start to renounce their possessions and maybe become a monk. And when they become a monk, first of all they take on the precepts of being a monk, or in a lay person the five precepts. And because of their take on the five precepts, they start getting the happiness of the precepts, what they call the blameless, the anuvaccha sukha of keeping the precepts. That gives you a certain type of happiness. But you go further than that and you start to restrain the senses, so you don't go watching TVs or listening to music. You restrain the senses, and because you restrain the senses, the mind stays inside, gets more energy and more happiness, and you get what's called the abhayasaka happiness. It's like the unsullied happiness, it's not so caught up in the world, it's more inside, a more peaceful, calm happiness. And after that, you start meditating, abandoning the hindrances and getting into the jhana, you get these other happinesses, these other bliss, and eventually as a result of those deep meditations, you get insight and get enlightened. And when you get enlightened, you understand birth is destroyed, the whole life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of existence. This householder is called the kind of person who does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself, who does not torment others or pursue the practice of torturing others. The one who, since he torments neither himself nor others, is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cold, and abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy. The point of this here, the Buddha introduced this, having said about Nibbana, now how do you get into Nibbana? And this last paragraph here was actually how that's done. But it also implies that anything other than that is either hurting yourself or hurting others, which is very true. Because denying yourself that enlightenment, denying yourself that bliss, by indulging in the world, is hurting yourself and is harming others. So sometimes that we think, oh no, we don't need to get enlightened yet. But when you're not enlightened, you will always have some craving, some ill will, and eventually that will harm and hurt yourself and harm and hurt others. So really, if you do want to live a harmless life, then we have to sort of somehow get beyond these defilements which cause us to say rotten things to our wife, cause us to not look after our body and mind, and cause us a lot of pain and difficulties because we can't let go of those attachments and those cravings which we know cause us so many problems. So the Buddha is saying that these things are part of tormenting yourself. It's also the cause why we torment others, because of our defilements and cravings. So if you do want to follow a path which neither torments yourself and not torments others, a true path of harmlessness, then one has to follow the path all the way to enlightenment. And be a truly harmless person. So, any comments on that? He finishes off with the usual bit of praise. When this was said, the Brahmin householders of Sala said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the darkness for those with eyesight to see forms. We go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today let Master Gotama accept us as lay followers who have gone to him for refuge for life." Now you may think, oh, that's just added, they always put that in. But there is one sutta, the first sutta, if you want to have a look at it. That is the one place where after giving a teaching the people weren't delighted, they weren't happy. And that wasn't always the case, the Buddha gave a sutta and people really got inspired by it. On the number one in here, they didn't understand a word of it, that's why they never delighted in it. So when it does actually say that they got inspired by it, the chances are they were. So to sum up that sutta, a long one, which is why I haven't read it out yet, but I managed to get it in with an hour and a half, is all about people who are skeptics, who weren't likely to believe anything unless it was argued. They weren't going to believe just there's a God or there's enlightenment. When the Buddha was saying rebirth, because there is rebirth, then it's really good to do to be good. If there isn't, it's still a smart thing to be good. But if you don't believe in rebirth, absolutely, there's likelihood you're not going to have as much incentive to do good and be a good person. And you might sort of, you don't really know whether there's rebirth or not until you die, you guys. So you might as well believe in it and do good. The doctrine of karma, it's up to you. Your karma has consequences, whether you believe in a God or not a God, it's what you do has the consequences. And if you believe in the consequences of karma, you'd have the incentive to do good karma. If you believe it doesn't really work, the incentive is not to do good karma, so you get into trouble in this life, and if there is results of karma, you get into trouble in your next life as well. And causality, life is not fated, it's not a grand plan by some god or whatever, so it means that you are responsible, you are in that sense control of your destiny. There is causality. And if you believe in that, you will actually do something to become better people rather than just accepting your lot of fate. And there are immaterial realms, other realms other than this realm of existence. If you believe that there is, there's a positive to that. And the cessation of being Nibbana, is Nibbana the cessation or not? Another big debate even these days amongst monks even. But if you believe that there is a cessation of being, then that is much closer to the non-lust, the non-binding, the non-delighting, the non-holding, which is a cause. It's a cause of letting go. It's a cause for cessation. So he said that's the way to go. If you know it, fine. But if you don't know it, it's still worth doing. And when it mentioned Nibbana, then how to become enlightened. By not harming yourself and not harming others. Take that right to the very end. That's why that sometimes we say, when we give the five precepts, silena sukhati jnanti, silena bhoga sampada, silena nibbati jnanti, he said these precepts lead to nibbana. And you say, how can precepts lead to nibbana? You know, you just can't keep precepts. You've got to meditate and become wise and all this sorts of stuff. Yes, but the essence of precepts is not harming yourself, not harming others. And if you take that not harming others, not harming yourself, or the Buddha here is saying not torturing or tormenting yourself and others, then that can only lead in one direction, all the way to enlightenment. Because you realize, yeah, you're going to keep precepts, you're going to be good people, but why is it that sometimes you can't be good? Why is it you do get upset and hurt other people? Because of these defilements in the mind. So in order to be able to be a kind person, a person who can love, who doesn't have any hurt or harm in them, you have to train your mind. And that training of the mind is the path to enlightenment. So to be compassionate to all beings, you have to be enlightened. If you don't want to harm others, you have to train your mind. So those
precepts of non-harming lead all the way to enlightenment. Any comment or question on that? Thank you for bearing with this long sutta. So one of the difficult ones, not one of the easy ones, but I'm going through the ones I haven't talked on before. The really easy ones I've already done and other monks have done. So these are one of the ones you haven't heard before. You've heard it here the first time. Thank you for listening. So now we can pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṁ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅghaṁ namāmi